The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
A monk said, "I've just arrived here, and I beg the master to point out a gate whereby I may enter." Xuanzha said, "Do you hear the sound of the water in Yan Creek?" The monk said, "I hear it." Xuanzha said, "That's the place of your entry." So, thinking about this koan, this little dialogue from the record of our ancestor Xuanzha, I looked a little bit into his life story, and I found a great deal in it to be motivated by. One of the things about him was that he didn't find the Dharma, unlike many of the teachers we hear about, until he was 30, which in China at that time was a lot older than 30. This should be something for those of us who started later in life to find reassuring. He became this great Zen master, a student of Sui Feng, who has his own wonderful stories, and the teacher of many people who eventually started a whole new school of Zen called the Fayan School. Xuanzha is known for being a brilliant student of his master Sui Feng, even though he started out when what we might consider being middle-aged. He was very clear in his understanding of the Dharma right away. And Sui Feng apparently really valued him as a Dharma heir. Sui Feng had many, many Dharma heirs, and many schools of Zen sprouted from them. And also, some of his Dharma heirs, the lineage ended with them, but not so for Xuanzha. So while I was thinking about this entering here instruction of Xuanzha's, I remembered that he was the subject of one of my favorite teaching stories, which I'd never been able to find since I first heard it discussed in a Dharma talk. It's not part of our koan tradition, but it is part of the record of Sui Feng. And it deals with a day in the monastery, in Sui Feng's monastery, when he suddenly went into the Dharma hall, the place where everyone meditated and listened to talks, and he lit a fire in the middle of the Dharma hall, and then he locked all the doors, and he shouted, "Fire! Fire!" Nobody knew what to do because they couldn't get in. But Xuanzha came along, and he threw a log in through the window. And so then Sui Feng, the teacher, came out. So what's going on in this story? I've been sitting with that all night since I found it in this book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, which I love so much, the stories of so many of our Zen ancestors in China. Stories that some of which have found their way into our koan tradition, but others more obscure like that one. It always makes me remember the story of Layman Pang and his daughter, who were walking along one day selling firewood and bamboo baskets, and their backs were loaded with these things, and suddenly Layman Pang slipped and fell, and his daughter, Ling Zhao, I think was her name, she came running along and fell down beside him, and he said, "What are you doing?" And she said, I saw you fall, so I thought I would help. So what is going on with these people helping? Swansha throws a log onto the fire to join in with his teacher. Ling Zhao falls into the mud with her father, who was her teacher, to help. How is this helpful? What's going on here? And for me, I think these stories have something in common. When we encounter suffering as bodhisattvas, like we talked about earlier, the bodhisattva Guan Yin, the bodhisattva of compassion, who with all her hands and eyes hears the suffering of the world and feels it deeply. We're not meant to be Zen robots. Although I do want to reassure people that every reaction to witnessing suffering is a reaction from Guan Yin. Even if you're feeling nothing whatsoever, that's how you're coping. So important. So important to value your own bodhisattva style. There are many bodhisattvas, not just the bodhisattva of compassion. Everyone has a different style of moving into the world of dukkha, the world of suffering, and finding a way to be helpful. And not helpful in the ordinary way, you know, really maybe an ordinary person seeing their teacher lock himself up in the zendo and start a bonfire would try to break down the doors and put the fire out. That's not what Swansha did. Maybe the daughter of a great teacher like Layman Pang sees her father fall down and goes and runs and tries to get him up. But that's not what Ling Zhao did. There first has to be the feeling, the connection to dukkha, the connection to suffering. When we witness something going on that we feel is unjust, that we feel is wrong or dangerous, sometimes our first action is to try to figure something out in our minds and go and do it. But Zen counsels a different way. Zen says to truly be the bodhisattva of compassion, we must feel fully that suffering. We have another koan in our tradition. I'm not sure where it comes from, but the line that we look into, it's in our miscellaneous koans, is why do perfectly accomplished saints and bodhisattvas weep at the red-purple line, the line which means the line of being a fully passionate human being. Sometimes it refers to our sexuality, our body sensations, our sense perceptions, but also the weeping has to do with seeing how being in a body causes us suffering. Just being a human being is enough. Those of us with temporary or chronic illnesses know what this is like. We so much don't want to have this happening. We want to have things different. I can speak of myself. I don't like having both a chronic disease and a temporary viral disease. I don't like it. I want it to be different than the way it is. I want to be able to do things that because of my physical condition, I haven't been able to do for decades. How do I learn to live with those things? I always remember, it was quite a long time ago, maybe 40, 50 years ago, I developed a case of mononucleosis. And I was pretty sick. And I'd never really been that sick before in my life. I'd had various colds and flus and things growing up. But this was really, really knocked me down, if any of you have ever had mono. Just exhausting. I was so surprised, and it lasted a long time. And I ended up going to, this was the 1970s, I ended up going to a hypnotherapist. And the hypnotherapist had me find my way deep into my unconscious and have a discussion with the virus. I thought that was really interesting at the time, but I just went along with it. And it was so interesting because I started to imagine, you know, the mind is so full of the capacity to create reality. So I created a reality for these viruses that had invaded my body, these monoviruses. They were little tiny blue creatures, kind of like Smurfs, and they had moved in to my sinuses and my throat and my lungs, and they had created beautiful homes there, little caves, little Smurf caves. And when I talked to them, I said, "I really need you to move out." And they said, "Why? We love it here. This is the nicest place we've ever been. Thank you so much for hosting us." And I didn't know what to do. I was in this deep trance, and I was sharing what was happening with the therapist, the hypnotherapist. And he invaded my little thing. He said, "I think you need to ask them to find another place. Just be aware of how you can be loving towards them, and also be firm. Say, not here. This is not the place I want you to be." And so I went back inside and did that, and reluctantly, with a lot of sighing and complaining, but a kind of friendliness, they took out these little blue suitcases and they packed up all their stuff and they left. Now, I don't know if that caused my mononucleosis to go away. In fact, for a long time, I felt the effects of the mono. It took me a while to get my strength back and to clear my sinuses and my lungs. But I always remember that little conversation that I had with them. It wasn't like, "Get out of here, you idiots." It was, "I appreciate that you like it here, and I really would like you to go somewhere else." It was a different way of encountering my wish for things to be different. Instead of just demanding that things were different, fighting, killing, getting rid of, which was really popular back in the 70s. People with cancer would sometimes be instructed to pretend they had guns and bombs and go in and bomb the cancer. Not leading from my experience later as a hospice worker and a grief counselor to really nice outcomes. The hostility that people were carrying around towards their own body processes was not so productive for living a life of ease and joy. But that's another story. In Zen practice, we don't talk about wanting to get rid of things. When we say letting go, we don't mean get rid of. We mean letting be. We mean letting come and go. We mean letting, allowing, being present. In the Buddhist time and in Tsuantzha's time and in the time of every human being who's ever lived on the planet, there have been diseases taking over bodies and killing them or debilitating them. There have been wars where people fight to the death for some idea, or some idea not that they have, but that their leaders have. This is how human beings are. There's been famine, not enough to eat. There's been intense suffering. The Buddha himself, when he first awakened to suffering, it was before his time under the Bodhi tree. It was when he was much younger, when he was still a prince, and he was watching the plowing of a field. And he suddenly saw. This was before his great awakening, but he was already someone who was ripe for awakening because he felt in his own body the suffering of all the little worms and creatures who were being plowed up by the plows being carried through the fields by the oxen. And he realized right then that there was something he was missing in his life of privilege, just like so many of us leading our lives of privilege. So I'm not just talking about working with little blue viruses or feeling the suffering of worms being chopped up, but the suffering that we carry around in our own bodies and hearts and minds. We're addicted to these automatic thoughts, these ideas, these ways of carrying forward fears, anger, divisiveness. And counterintuitively, the teaching of Zen says, don't try to get rid of those things. Don't try to be somebody other than who you are. The Buddha himself wept when he saw the suffering of those little worms. And then later, when he was under the Bodhi tree, and he was assailed by his own inner demons, or sometimes the story is expressed as an outer demon coming to him, Mara, with armies assailing him with suffering, temptations. There was no internet that back then, but Mara was clever and knew how to set up just the right kinds of thoughts for the Buddha to get lost in. And the Buddha saw all this stuff coming towards him, and he didn't budge. It washed through him and over him. And then he realized that this feeling of dukkha, of things being a little bit or a lot out of balance, is a characteristic of being human. It's a characteristic of the world. It's a noble truth. It was his first teaching. Not an unfortunate truth, remember, but a noble truth. Suffering is a part of life. Dukkha is a part of life. Political upheavals, injustice, wars and famines and epidemics, all part of the world. So how do we meet them? And the teachings, as they went forward over the years, over the centuries, until they, as Alan was saying to us last night, merged with Taoism in China. And also, I have to add Confucianism, a certain way of understanding that change is always present, that no matter what's happening, it won't last. It will be replaced by something else. The great teaching that comes to us from Confucius and from the Taoists, and ultimately from the Buddha. These three ways of practicing spirituality all had that in common. And Zen has the rootedness in change as one of its inherent characteristics. Things don't last. All that is dear to me and everyone I love, all, not just a few things, all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. There is no way to avoid being separated from them. When we really face into this, then we begin to get a little glimpse of what these teachers are trying to tell us. When Xuanzha throws the log in the window, he's joining in with this created suffering of his teacher. Starting a fire in the middle of the Zendo? We're sure not going to do that. What's his point? Only Xuanzha understood. Only Xuanzha understood that there is, in fact, a great fire consuming us all the time. And why not participate fully in it when we're angry about something going on? To be fully angry, to give the anger a huge, huge field to operate in, not through our activities, not through saying angry words and doing angry deeds, but to feel the quality of the anger fully inside of us. Until In the Mahayana tradition, we say that anger, when it's given free rein, when the fire burns fully, it burnishes the sword of wisdom. It turns into the sword of wisdom. It cuts through delusion. Burning away, Rumi in one of his poems says, actually attributes God as saying to Moses in a wonderful poem, "I want burning. Burn up all your thoughts and ideas." What does this mean for us as Zen students? What is this burning? And similarly, if there's sadness, grief, hopelessness, despair, when we're sitting upright and unmoving, we get to have that feeling fully. We don't have to pretend that everything is okay. If we weep, we weep. We join with Guanyin in her great weeping. If we rage, we rage. We join with the Bodhisattva Manjushri in his great cutting through. And maybe there's nothing in your heart at all. There's just, oh, well, whatever. Or maybe not even that. Maybe there's a kind of numbness. I really was lucky in my life to have many, many different professions. And the one where I was able to be with people who were dying and with people whose loved ones had died, I saw that no one grieved the same. And for me, grief is the reaction to things not being the way we want them to be. I remember that when I was a young therapist, I was taught a form of quick therapy. I can't remember exactly the name of it. I think it was called the Milan method. And it began with asking the client, if you could wake up tomorrow morning and everything would be different, how would you want it to be? And I was young and I thought, that's a cool question. And then the therapy went on from there to just keep imagining how you could live that kind of life, how you could live a life into what you really wanted. But when I started practicing that with grief clients, the very first time I tried it, the middle-aged widow whose husband had died at the age of 50 looked at me in shock and horror. "Are you kidding me?" she said. "I want my husband to be alive." And that was the beginning of me understanding that there was a lot I didn't understand. So we went with that. We went right into that feeling, that know that we were talking about yesterday. Saying yes to the no, as we might say. How is it that human beings have survived this long on the planet, partly through this capacity to create alternate scenarios, to plan ahead, to say, this terrible thing might happen, so I'm gonna make sure it doesn't happen. And then that gets co-opted into a life of living in fear, imagining all kinds of things, all kinds of disasters. And it's not foolish, because there have indeed been all kinds of disasters throughout human history. We are not going to make it out of here. No one is. The statistics on death are clear. 100% of us will die. There's nothing that will get in the way of that. The only thing we don't know is when and how. And even when we get diagnosed with some terrible disease, even when we're imprisoned and tortured, we still don't know when, and we don't even know how. The mind becomes concentrated in these moments when there's no escape. one of Pema Chodron's books, the great Tibetan Buddhist American teacher, is called The Wisdom of No Escape. In a way, we make an artificial no escape here. I mean, really, there's an escape, but sitting upright for 25 minutes without moving, bearing whatever is arising, impatience, pain, all the scenarios of the future, all the scenarios of what's happening, what should be happening. This is a perfect instructional material to allow us to see that our own suffering, and this was the second noble truth of the Buddha, not an unfortunate truth, but a noble truth, is caused by wanting things to be different than the way they are. Seems so simple, but when we go into that wanting mind, when we make friends with it, when we welcome it into our lives instead of just saying, get out of here, get out of here. When we realize, as the Buddha eventually did in his life, that Mara, the demonic force that assailed him under the Bodhi tree, was his true companion. And they became friends, and they stayed together, according to the legend, until the very last moments of the Buddha's life. When he was assassinated by one of his students. Sound familiar? This is what happens with human beings. We don't know what the future will bring, and we keep trying to figure it out. But the instruction is, as Dogen says, to take the backward step, to go right into what's happening right now and value it, because it's life rising up in all its beauty and terror as this. Whatever it is, fear, anger, sadness, numbness, delight, joy, laughter, sorrow, all the different forms that life takes, they arise and they pass away. And we too arise and we too pass away. I want to end with a little poem that I've loved for decades, since I first encountered it. It's like so many of us, poetry arises when we encounter the world, if we have some familiarity with poetry, and especially when we encounter difficult circumstances. I remember reading this poem to one of my students who died a few years ago, and using the last line as a wado, the little kernel of practice that we sometimes use in our koan practice. For example, mu is the wado of the koan mu. And the last line of this poem became a touchstone for me, and still is, and became a touchstone for him as well. And we would sometimes just say it to each other and laugh. So here's the poem. It's by Gary Snyder, who is still alive, I was happy to learn recently, in his 90s, a wonderful Zen teacher, woodsman, wilderness expert, who spent some time in Japan, came back here, and lived a life of being both a poet and a Zen teacher. Still going on, writing poetry. This is from one of his early works, and I love the title. Why log truck drivers rise earlier than students of Zen? Why log truck drivers rise earlier than students of Zen? So I'm going to read it and comment a little bit on it and then read the whole thing again. Here's the poem. In the high seat, before dawn dark. Just imagine yourself into that moment. You're a log truck driver, big, big truck. The high seat, the before dawn dark, going up the hill in the darkness. polished hubs gleam and the shiny diesel stack warms and flutters up the Tyler Road grade to the logging on Poorman Creek. 30 miles of dust. There is no other life. Why log truck drivers rise earlier than students of Zen? In the high seat before dawn dark, polished hubs gleam and the shiny diesel stack warms and flutters up the Tyler Road grade to the logging on Poorman Creek. 30 miles of dust. There is no other life. There is no other life. Enter here. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and are as comfortable as you're able. And we'll have our Dharma dialogue. Yes, Madhu.
Thank you for your talk. It really reminds me, it reminds me again and again your talk, that no matter how much we talk about suffering, it's never enough. And, you know, we human beings are always going to hope that there is some other way that bypasses suffering, but there is no other way. So suffering is the only way. And it reminds me about this quotation by Carl Jung. One doesn't get enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making darkness conscious. And it's my favorite quote. And yeah, there is darkness, and darkness is the only way. And it's my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By making darkness conscious. That's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Jenny.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa. I loved so much in it, but the Gary Snyder is fresh now. And I was thinking of my dad, who I didn't like very much, and when he died, I had to fill his shoes for a while and be a landlord in Alaska in the winter, and I thought about being, you know, under the apartments and thawing the frozen pipes, and I thought about him just doing that like he was never gonna die right up to the end. And I remember it now, like that was living.
There was no other life for him, fully living.
Yeah.
For you too.
Me too. Yeah.
For all of us, really.
Yeah, the poem, the vividness of it, the 30 miles of dust, such a wonderful evocation, and the high seat of the truck. Of course, there's the high seat of the Zen master, the high seat of your father, and in his, the fullness of his life, and you in the fullness of your life. And it's like, oh, this is it. Right, pointing, like, oh, I thought this was something we were getting through, but no, crawling under unfreezing frozen pipes in the middle of Alaska winter. No other way.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anne.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. But there was something I didn't understand, and of course I couldn't write it down, so I'm probably misquoting it. You are talking about the Zen way of going into the anger and experiencing the anger fully. And the people I've known who've done that ended up in a very bad place. So I'm misinterpreting it somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very subtle place. As Melissa was talking, I was thinking of one of the coaching adages I was given when I was training to be a life coach, is don't get in the boat with your client. Ling Chao falling down into the mud. So there are ways we can join in that anger, the inner anger, and get caught up by it. And the anger is then running the show, and the words were acting it out in some way. But this other way that Melissa was talking about was joining in without becoming its partner. And this is the upright dignity of our Zen way, not to get lost in our stories of anger, not to get lost in letting whatever emotion du jour, you name it. We can perpetuate it and it gets stronger and stronger. So I think we've all seen people get lost in their anger. But this way is much more being with, not getting carried away. And so this idea of creating this large pasture, so when the anger comes, instead of thinking the thoughts that the anger led to and leads from that goes around and around, we actually are with it as the experience of the moment. We feel the heat of it. We are intimate with it in a way that if we just yell and act it out, we're avoiding it.
And this pasture that David Roshi just mentioned, this is what we're doing here. This is what we're doing in Sesshin, this pasture to allow whatever arise and but still have this great space for it, this great field that this boundless field that the anger and whatever arises can exist and change as Melissa was saying.
And I think as we meet people, this meeting them, allowing our hearts to break, is not the same as believing whatever story they're telling. Right? So this is not saying, oh yeah, the world really is gonna this or that, but feeling the truth of their experience, whatever it is, it's their experience and it's a human experience. So very subtle and a hugely important distinction. Thank you for bringing it up.
And just a little bit more about that. So anger is a really interesting emotion to feel in the body and not act on, which is what we're all saying, right? We're not talking about acting on it. But when we make that big field, we give space to being able to see, oh, those are what my angry thoughts are. This is what my body feels like in anger. This is what other emotions might accompany it. Often grief is underneath anger. And one of the metaphors we often use when we talk about this, making the big field, is like if you have a little cup of water and you put a little drop of ink, black ink, in it, it colors the water. But if you have a big, big bowl of water and you put ink in it, it's just kind of gray. And then, of course, if you put a drop of ink in the ocean, it doesn't do anything. So this is the expanding the field. This is what we're talking about. Then we can really be present with our anger without, as David said, it's not just other people's stories, our own stories, without believing our thoughts, but really noticing, oh, I'm having those thoughts. Yeah, very important, Anne. Thank you. Rich.
I love the blue Smurf, and it reminds me of a technique that I've practiced through therapy, where when I get caught in my thinking, kind of envision this like guardian who doesn't want me to let go. And I can't really push him away. I just have to ask nicely, would you just step back for a little bit? Mm-hmm. And usually he says yes, maybe because I'm polite or something. And so it just reminded me of that. It's not always easy to execute, but just envisioning that.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's not a the practice we're talking about is not a technique.
Right, right.
That's a technique. And the little Smurf visualization was a technique. I still was sick for weeks after that.
Right, right.
Even after they packed up their bags and left. So if we're looking for a particular outcome, that's not our way.
Mm-hmm.
That because then right. just is a subtler way of trying to argue with reality.
Well, techniques are wonderful, you know, and for working with ourselves, all of us can notice when we're heading down some way. And there are lots of wonderful little techniques, skillful means that can be useful so that we can get to the real thing here beyond all this.
Yeah. Yeah. Our favorite skillful means is sitting upright and unmoving for 25 minutes. That seems to be a great skillful means. Right. Thank you, Rich. Beverly.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. I observed something interesting. Whenever I encounter koans and in your teachings, for example, I always have this reaction, I don't get it, you know, just, and then when at the end, when you read the poem and that line, there is no other life, it was like a thrill. and I thought, what does that mean? And it was interesting to see how that, you know, that can take away the whatever answer came inside of me. This wanting to understand it with words and concepts. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I go, you said it over again, so then I could sort of reconnect with the thrill, and then that's enough. And
yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sometimes about koans we say dark to the mind and radiant to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think part of what we're doing is learning to trust what we cannot speak of, to trust something deeper than the construction of our words. I love that she read it again and you could practice. Maybe I can let it be enough, just this vibrating in harmony with this.
And Beverly, this I don't get it, is the valley stream. It is the life that there is no other. It's, I don't get it.
Ugh. And my head goes crazy, you know. What does this mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's it, you know, when I love what Michael just said. There nothing is excluded.
Yeah.
There's no way to be. In Zen practice, maybe in Zen forms, there's a way to enact the forms, but even that, quite variable. There's no way that doesn't include everything. And so it's very important to accept, I don't get it. And also the thrill is a Dharma gate towards understanding how to work with koans. If it's just la, 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 oh yeah, that makes sense. Next. Mm. But I felt the same thrill when I first heard that poem. In fact, the whole beginning of the poem for years was like, that's not, but then that line, that's really true to me.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Susan Herman.
Thank you for the talk. You just said just this line. And for me, listening today to the koan There was one line I heard differently when the, or it evoked something different for me. When the student went to the teacher and said, "I just arrived here." And I'm quite sure yesterday it was just, okay, this is the intro of the koan.
Right.
And today it was, "I just arrived here." And then the student asked a question about, "Tell me something, teacher." And the teacher was not trying to be helpful, but yeah, so and was responding. But for me, it is, "I just arrived here." The student had already the answer within, and there was, and this is what I'm doing all the time. I'm just, oh, I'm, yeah, reading books, going to Dokusan, going to Sesshin, and asking, and blah, blah, blah. So, and I just arrived here. So,
And
and I
that's
just want to
yeah,
share.
it's very similar to what Beverly was just saying, the thrill of hearing those words and all their, the funny thing about koans, so the koans are gossip that have been solidified into stories and repeated and repeated and repeated until they were written down, in the not until the 12th century, 11th and 12th centuries. And all the so for me, all the words in the koan are important. It's not just get through it. It's like the high seat, sitting in the high seat in Gary Snyder's poem. That's an important little piece of it. All of it's important. So not to dismiss, Or if we do dismiss it, remember that's it too. Just like I don't get it, right? Or whatever. Eventually we're ripe enough, open enough to hear these things freshly and understand their significance for us and for being human in the world. Yeah.
Yeah,
Thanks,
thanks,
Susan.
Susan. Lovely.
Susan Lamar.
Yes, thank you. There was just so much in that talk. It's hard to know where to go, but it reminded me of a story, and I hope you'll bear with me for a minute because it's going to sound for at first like a diversion, but it's not. The whole image of the logging truck brought up a personal story for me. A year ago, I was with a friend, and we were driving around Oregon, and we got lost and ended up at the end of a road that just kind of it seemed like a road going somewhere, and we thought it was going somewhere, and it just stopped at what turned out to be a logging road going up a very, very steep hill. There wasn't really a place for us to turn around, so we were so he said, "Well, let's just go explore. Let's go up that hill," which we started to do. I was driving because she was too sick or having trouble with her eyes, and it was, so I was driving her car, an unfamiliar car, and we heard this roar. And here comes a logging truck with two guys in the front seat, barreling down toward us in this hill. And there wasn't really any place for us to go. So I said to her, very Zen fashion, "I think I should back up." And I backed up and managed to get out of the way. They did not slow down one tiny little bit. They just came barreling right down. So we're sitting there, sort of catching our breath, and I said, "Well, that was an adventure." And but when you told the story, the relationship here is, our society feels like now like a logging truck is barreling down at us, and there's a so some of us have this incredibly helpless sensation, and yet if we just cope with this is this is our life right now. there things I hope will begin to happen. We'll be able to, because the normal things that we have been doing haven't worked in the way we have wanted them to work.
Right.
But this is the life we are in right now. This is the only life there is for each of us individually.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we're helpless.
Well, and really, speaking of skillful means, really appreciate the skillful means of sometimes we back down quite quickly and get off that road, which allows
get out
us,
of the way.
Yeah, then to act in some skillful way later on. You did not say, oh, locking truck and my car, no problem. Boom.
Right.
No, no, back up, out of the way.
Get the hell out of here.
Right. Back the fuck up.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I really appreciate about your story and also the poem itself, you know, Gary Snyder was one of the first eco warriors, right? He was very much against logging like this. And yet he was able, and I think this is a lesson. Some of us talked about this on Friday at the Tea with the Teachers, of making sure we keep remembering that everyone's life has an inner consistency, and that, you know, for him to be able to really get inside what it must be like to be to be that log truck driver, having been a student of Zen for, you know, many years leading up to that, that's what we have to do also. Doesn't mean we don't get out of the way when people are barreling down at us. And, you know, a number of us, I think, are preoccupied with, well, it's nice to be at Sesshin, but so what's going to happen when we leave, and, you know, social media and other people, and we're going to get triggered and all this kind of stuff. Sometimes you just back the fuck down, right? You don't engage, but you also don't other and fight and say no. To those people, human beings who are like us in almost every other way.
Right.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Susan. No, it's a new koan for our collection. Dave Linshaw, did you have your hand up?
I did, but you just said what I was thinking was how beautiful. Like, I know that Gary Snyder is this environmentalist, and when Susan was talking, this kind of personalization of the logging story, it made me personalize, and I have this aversion to logging too. Like, I see it as this kind of gross thing where we're killing these forests, and it feels bad, and so there's something that I you know, I see a forest and I have a I love it, and I see these kind of, you know, 30 miles of dusty logged road, and I feel bad. But what in this poem, what I loved about it was that it made it like it was when you're talking about the Buddha being friends with Mara for the rest of his life, where like this ability to the high seat and the shiny the hubs and the smokestack, and like all of it was just this like. There was like, he was like giving it grace, like he was giving it dignity and giving it love, like this thing that we find to be awful in some way too. And so yeah, that's what came to me. But then you started talking about it, so I figured I don't want to reinvent the wheel.
and so Gary Snyder wrote this beautiful poem, and he did not stop being an activist. And working toward what he loved. So
yeah,
not either or.
And David, I think you're pointing to something, the act of humanizing the other, the other being an enemy. It's an incredibly transformative act to humanize, and as opposed to objectify another human being, even if we vehemently disagree with what they're doing.
Yeah. Thank you. Bix?
Yeah, so on a similar topic, you know, hard to ignore the political situation and the fact that many of the people on that side don't really care for my existence as a human being who is trans. And so, you know, some of these people, they really just wish I wasn't alive, and are willing to, it seems like, willing to go through, take action to erase my life, or at the very least my identity. And, you know, I think it's easy for me when I'm not so emotionally attached to the situation and it's not personal to me to like, hold compassion for the enemy, when it comes to lots of different things. But when you are, when I'm somebody who's, you know, being actively targeted, it is a lot harder, to hold compassion in ways that I'm usually able to, because I don't intend to go down without a fight. You know what I mean? So,
of course. Yeah. Holding compassion for, as you say, the enemy is way down the road. The first thing is to actually feel your fear that people want to wipe you out. You know, growing up as a woman, anybody who's Black or Jewish or anything that any group of people that have been oppressed or wiped out in some cases, we carry this fear with us. And the fear is the first thing. Otherwise, it's just an idea to have compassion for somebody, right? You don't have compassion, but some people do. It's kind of amazing. But they haven't gotten there by avoiding the fear, the sadness, the anger. So start here. Enter here. Don't enter with ideas, right? Oh, I'm going to be compassionate to the enemy. Gary Snyder was a Zen practitioner and then a Zen master. He could write this poem because of all the inner work that he'd been doing. So this is what we have to do. Take the backward step. Yeah. And don't isolate from your allies. Thank you. Eugenia, and we'll just take a couple more. Eugenia. Eugenia, can you unmute yourself? We can't hear you or see you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you see me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I thank you for the beautiful talk, Melissa. I just want to expand on that and Biggs about the unwanted visitors with a little blue suitcases to which we have to write, "Dear visitors, you cause us pain, please go away." And we know that it doesn't work, or that is also a visitor in the end. Buddha ended up befriending the enemy. So you have to invite them, befriend them. I think that's also in a poem, and laugh at them, even if you don't have the same sense of humor as they do, somehow to try to laugh at those visitors. And thank you for your personal share. I also had almost lost my life during COVID. So I had dehydration and kidney failure. It was a heat wave and I was in a room without air condition. Mm-hmm. And I survived, and I lost also many significant others, people in that period, particularly since COVID. And for me, what works is really to kind of have that attitude of memento mori, to realize that death is there no matter what, and to dance with it. And it remembers me of one of the favorite movies of my generation, which is All That Jazz. talking to death. And I guess that's the only way, because there is no escape.
There really is no escape.
Yeah. And by the way, the story with the fire, why a Zen student was set afire in the Zendo, that I didn't get at all.
But that's fine. And, you know, to be Beverly here, I don't get it.
Was he seeking attention?
I'm not going to explain it to you. It was, and it was the Zen master, not a Zen student. It was Shui Fan.
More difficult.
We're not going to explain it to you. We want you to stay with this experience of, I don't get it. Don't try to figure it out. Or if you do try to figure it out, notice that you're trying to do that. And then just come back to this basic, I don't get it.
And this encouragement too, you know, so you have been through this experience of being so close to death, and as Melissa said over and over, no escape, as you were saying. So this, as you say, is part of, in some ways, how we can be brave and courageous, right? And none of our techniques are going to work, none of these things, but Zen is suggesting that at every moment, whatever the circumstance, the way in is with what's going on here. And wonderful when we can be nice to the little blue invaders with suitcases or joke with death, but also just fine when the terrible fear comes up and when the anger comes up. So, again and again, although techniques are wonderful, how do we enter into the moment that we are in, whether we think it's the right one we should be in or not? This is the mysterious instruction of Zen, not to get to the right place in our thinking, but to be where we are, which is the right place. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Eugenia. And I had said we were just going to have one more. I saw Crystal's hand go up. So let Crystal be the last one and let Alan come next.
Oh, Alan now. Then
Alan first. Now. Then Crystal just okay. snuck her hand in. Okay. After, right.
Thank you. So just quickly going back to Gary Snyder, not sure that everyone knows that Gary Snyder himself worked on logging crews in his 20s. And he was all for certain traditional kinds of logging and selective kinds of logging. What he was against was clear cutting and cutting down ancient redwoods and violating wilderness areas. But I think he cut down trees all his life. I doubt he's still doing it because he's in his 90s.
Yeah.
But this is not in the interest of being, you know, making a footnote, but of resisting an either or logic, you know, that we don't have to say, don't ever cut down any tree or clear cut all of them. And so I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did, Alan, because it's very easy to get into these opposing camps, right? And to put them in a camp and us in the other camp. This is what we do all the time. So also to appreciate for ourselves, you know, that we get angry, we want to kill, we get sad, we want to run away. All these things are part, Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes, right? And everybody does. And one of the things I really appreciate about Gary Snyder is he's never been politically correct. He was one of the big voices against vegetarianism. I remember when everybody I knew was saying, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you should never eat meat. And he was saying, yeah, you should. Lots of Buddhists eat meat. You know, he always had these nuanced views. And I think nuance is important here to find the areas of commonality with people who want to kill us. I just want to say one more quick thing. I almost put this in the talk, but then I'll try to say it quickly. When I first found out that my first Zen teacher had been sleeping with one of the students in the Sangha, I was just devastated. And for some reason, I had packed in my suitcase for this retreat training thing that was going on when I found out about it, a book called Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. And I really recommend it. It was all these little stories of exceptions to cruelty, because the people who were in the position of being exterminated didn't give in to their own, they resisted and they survived. These were all tales of survivors, but they didn't other the guards, the people who were being destructive to them. This is really advanced spiritual work. And for some reason that book stuck with me for years to keep my interviews nuanced, even though it's so easy, isn't it, to fall into opposing camps. So thanks for that. And last word, Crystal.
What really resonated with me were the stories where the daughter and the student fall down and are helping by really feeling what the other is feeling, by really, because my helping is mostly trying to fix it or to hold it.
Yeah.
And I think I skip the step of being with,
Well, I think that's so easy to do, especially because other people's suffering, especially people we care about, is hard for us to bear. Like, oh, sweetie, I don't want you to be feeling so terrible. Let me fix it. So this stopping and feeling terrible, this is how human beings feel sometimes. And trusting that in whatever is happening, there's some seed of wisdom. And if we fix it or cover it over, we miss whatever is there. So some act of faith and courage and being willing to be uncomfortable, great bodhisattva service.
Yeah, so thank you, Crystal, and thanks to everyone who participated, whether you spoke up or not. And let's come back to our posture for Zazen.